The Nevada sat on the bottom too, and in the wreckage of the captain's quarters a sword lay twisted and burned behind a charred bureau. Later, when Captain Scanland found it there, he held it out in both his hands and turned to CPO Jack Haley, who happened to be standing nearby. "Chief, my mother and dad gave me this sword when I graduated from the Naval Academy many years ago." Haley could sense all the captain's pent-up emotion and grief at being away from his ship during the attack. The chief understood perhaps better than most, for the Nevada meant everything to him, too. She was his first and only ship, his home for the past 12 years. He couldn't hold back the tears. Down in the Nevada's plotting room, Ensign Merdinger stubbornly stuck to his post. He knew from the water dripping into the room that the deck above was flooded. And he knew from the silent phones that few hands were left below decks. There was no longer any need for an information center. Still, he hated to leave. At 3 o'clock, a rush of water through the seams of the door left no other choice. He phoned topside and was told to come on up. While the water poured in and swirled around the crew's feet, they carefully unplugged the phones, neatly coiled the extension lines, and hung them on their usual hooks. But the casual approach had its limits. As the men scrambled up the shaft to the conning tower, it occurred to Merdinger that normally some of them might have difficulty making the climb. This time there was no trouble at all. On deck, preparations were being made for a last-ditch stand. Someone handed Marine Private Peyton McDaniel a rifle and 2 rounds of ammunition. Slender rations, but McDaniel later discovered the rifle had no firing pin anyhow. A Marine detail was sent to the beach to dig emplacements for the World War I machine guns and bars that had been salvaged. The basic defense plan: hold the ship as long as possible, then take to the hills. At Hickam, Corporal John Sherwood and Master Sergeant Bonnie Neighbors were also preparing for a last stand. They dragged an old C-33 into the boondocks, dug a good position around it, and set up 2 machine guns. Private J.H. Thompson joined another man from the 50th Reconnaissance Squadron, who had established a machine gun nest near the ruined Snake Ranch. The man had taken the trouble to stock it with beer and wine salvaged from the wreckage. Some of the bottles were broken and the bugs had to be strained out, but this was a minor hardship. The 2 men cheerfully defended the position all afternoon. Help yourself was also the rule at the officers' club. Everyone expected the Japanese that night, so the food and refreshments might as well be free. At base headquarters, Colonel Cheney Bertolf, the post adjutant, carted out his files and burned them. Even Colonel Farthing, the base commander, was sure the Japanese planned to take over Hickam. That was why they didn't bomb the runways or control tower. Master Sergeant M.D. Mannion felt the place would fall so soon that he might as well pull out and go to Schofield. Up there he might at least be of some service in standing off the enemy. Actually, Schofield was on the move. Most of the infantry and artillery were now at assigned defense positions around the island. The 98th Coast Artillery at Wheeler, the 28th Infantry at Waikiki, the 27th farther down the shore, other units along the north coast, on the heights above Pearl, and at the bases on the windward side. As the long column of troops rolled into Kaneohe around 2:30 p.m., Mess Attendant Walter Simmons had only one thought. They had been run out of Schofield. But he, too, was prepared for a final stand. He now carried an old Springfield rifle and had bandoliers of ammunition strung over his shoulder and around his waist. He felt ready for anything and fancied that he looked just a little like Pancho Villa. The men shoveled out foxholes. Simmons dug his in the unfinished bottom of the officers' swimming pool and set up machine guns all over the steep hill in the center of the base. By sundown, Kaneohe was prepared for the next attack. The island's scattered defenses were now being directed by General Short from Aliamanu Crater, 3 miles west of Fort Shafter. The command post was established in a deep ordnance storage tunnel, ideal for holding out against the coming assault. The general had moved in during the morning, trailed by the usual retinue of staff and communications men. Lieutenant Samuel Bradlin was establishing the link with Hickam, and as he set up his code equipment, he watched General Short, General Martin, and other high-ranking officers huddle together. They looked terribly worried, and for the first time Bradlin realized that even generals were human beings who didn't always know what to do and had to pace back and forth while making decisions. Of one thing they were certain, there had to be martial law. General Short approached old Governor Poindexter on this shortly before noon. The governor dragged his feet. He thought it was probably necessary, yet he hated to do it. He finally said he wanted to check with the White House first, would give Short his answer in an hour. He put through a call to the president at 12:40 p.m., and it didn't help when the operator, now acting under the Navy censor, kept insisting, "What are you going to talk about?" The governor had been shoved aside already. The president was properly soothing, agreed that martial law was all for the best. Then Short reappeared to press the point. For all he knew, landing parties were on the way. The raid was probably the prelude to an all-out attack. He couldn't afford to take chances. The governor finally signed the proclamation, and martial law was announced at 4:25 p.m. The civilians considered themselves in the front lines anyhow. Edgar Rice Burroughs, creator of Tarzan, joined a group of men digging slit trenches along the shore. Others rallied to the Territorial Guard, which was hastily built around the University of Hawaii ROTC unit. As the 2nd Battalion mobilized at Wahiawa, a sergeant drove up in a command car with some welcome news. The Army had sent him over from Schofield to help. He was a godsend. The unit had no equipment, and the sergeant knew how to get everything. Blankets, mess gear, guns. He proved an ingenious, tireless worker and ultimately stayed with the outfit a whole month. Then one day he commandeered some whiskey from a padlocked liquor store, and that proved his undoing. When the proprietor complained, it turned out the man was no sergeant at all, just a prisoner released from the Schofield stockade during the raid. He had immediately stolen a sergeant's uniform, then the command car, and had been stealing ever since, filling the home guard's desperate needs. He was a sort of military Robin Hood. Nearly every organized group on Oahu staked out something to do. Boy Scouts fought fires, served coffee, ran messages. The American Legion turned out for patrol and sentry duty. One Legionnaire struggled into his 1917 uniform, had a dreadful time remembering how to wind his puttees and put on his insignia. He took it out on his wife, and she told him to leave her alone, go out and fight his old enemy, the Germans. The San Jose College football team, in town for a benefit game the following weekend, signed up with the police department for guard duty. 7 of them joined the force, and quarterback Paul Tognetti stayed on for good, ultimately going into the dairy business. A local committee called the Major Disaster Council had spent months preparing for this kind of day. Now their foresight was paying off. 45 trucks belonging to American Sanitary Laundry, New Fair Dairy, and other local companies sped off to Hickam as converted ambulances. Dr. Forrest Pinkerton dashed to the Hawaii Electric Company's refrigerator, collected the plasma stored there by the Chamber of Commerce's blood bank. He piled it in the back of his car, distributed it to various hospitals, then rushed on the air, appealing for more donors. Over 500 appeared within an hour, swamping Dr. John Devereux and his 3 assistants. They took the blood as fast as they could, ran out of containers, used sterilized Coca-Cola bottles. All kinds of people went through the line. Navy wife Maureen Hayter was shocked when offered a swig of old granddad afterward. It just didn't seem right. Another woman was a well-known prostitute. She couldn't give blood but wanted to do something. Dr. Devereux put her to work cleaning bottles and tubes. She turned out to be his most faithful volunteer. Civilian doctors and nurses converged on the Army's Tripler Hospital. Among them went Dr. John J. Moorhead, a distinguished New York surgeon who happened to be in Honolulu delivering a series of lectures. Some 300 doctors had attended his first talk Thursday morning, half of them Army and Navy men. Dr. Moorhead had been an Army surgeon in World War I, loved the service, and took great pains to see they were invited. The service doctors accepted with enthusiasm. Dr. Moorhead was a world-famous specialist, and, unlike almost everyone else, he could speak from actual battle experience. On Friday night, the doctor was slated to speak on back injuries, but at the last minute the schedule was juggled and he spoke instead on the treatment of wounds. If the program committee had known the attack was coming, it couldn't have lined up a better subject. Dr. Moorhead had Saturday off, but he was to speak on burns at 9 a.m. Sunday. As he ate his breakfast, guns boomed in the distance. Walking through the hotel lobby, he heard that Pearl Harbor was under attack. He told Dr. Hill, who was driving him to the lecture, but the local doctor was unimpressed. Oh, you hear all kinds of stories around this place. They turned on the car radio and picked up the 840 bulletin. That convinced them, and they dropped by Dr. Hill's house while he told his wife and children to take shelter. Then they drove on to the Mabel L. Smith Auditorium so that Dr. Moorhead could give his talk. The two doctors were having the same trouble as everyone else, making the lightning adjustment to war, realizing that it also affected their own day. The lecture hall was almost empty, only 50 doctors instead of the usual 300, and no Army or Navy men. As Dr. Moorhead reached the platform, shells began landing outside. He cheerily told the audience that the noise reminded him of Chateau Thierry. Then he pointed out that this was Sunday, so he would give a sermon with an appropriate text. Be ye also ready, for in the hour that ye know not.